from Lagos to Karachi, we've seen poorer cities emerge in poorer places, and they create both promise and enormous difficulties.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. It's that time of year again. It's time for the BREAD IGC virtual PhD level course in economics. The topic is urbanization and the economics of cities in low and middle income countries. We're going to be speaking to some of the presenters in the next few weeks, but what better way to start than to catch up with Ed Glaser of Harvard, Diego Puga of CEMFI, who gave the first talk on the idea of the dynamic city, and they join me now. Ed, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
And Diego, great to talk to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Why is it important to study how cities are evolving and changing if we're interested in development?
Because the future of the developing world is urban. In some sense, we have a knowledge mismatch, which is that for most of our history, much of development economics has thought about the lives of poor rural villagers trying to get by with subsistence agriculture. But increasingly, from Lagos to Karachi, we've seen poorer cities emerge in poorer places, and they create both promise and enormous difficulties. And it's a great topic for economists to explore. It's a great topic because it matters for ordinary people, because the economics are interesting, and because there's really a possibility of making the lives of poor urbanites better.
Yet our research hasn't made the transition to really think about cities in that context. We still do much of our work in more developed economies, right? So there's certainly lots of work to do. And it's an important task because that's where we have a lot to learn.
And we're certainly hoping for a post-COVID reboot. So to a certain extent, the economic work on developing world cities was disjointed, like much of development economics, because of the difficulties of traveling for several years. And we're really hoping now that this lecture series encourages a whole flourishing of research in developing world cities.
I imagine a lot of the attraction of cities is how much extra you can earn if you live in them or you travel to them. Is this universally the case?
It is universally the case, but with some differences, right? So it's certainly the case everywhere that people earn more in cities than in rural areas, and more in bigger cities than in smaller cities. Part of that is just a wedge in earnings between rural places and urban places, and that's the case everywhere. But that wedge is like an order of magnitude bigger in middle and low-income countries, right? So that gap is huge. Then within the urban part of the country, there's also differences between the cities of different sizes, where people also tend to earn more in bigger cities. And that, again, is an effect that is present both in higher-income countries and in lower-income countries. But there's not such a big difference. And another twist is that those advantages of big cities tend to be greater for more skilled workers, and that we can see very clearly in rich countries. In poorer countries, that's not so much the case. If anything, sometimes the premium is smaller for more skilled workers, right? And that's another crucial difference. So yes, it's something that we see everywhere, but with important differences between rich and poor countries.
So in Brazil, where I do work on wage differences, there's a real difference between the cities of the north and the cities of the south. Using Diego's word as a verb, if I de la Roca and Puga it up, which is just a way of measuring what the dynamic effects of locating a city on wages, we really see that in the south, the southern cities look a lot like the Spanish cities that Diego looked at, meaning that they're both good for wages initially and good for wage growth. In the north, we see much less of that. In a purely statistical sense, that difference is explained by the fact that the northern Brazilian cities have far more segregated workplaces than the southern Brazilian cities. They have low-skilled workers working with other low-skilled workers doing relatively simple things. And the ability of cities to be engines of opportunity, to be forges of human capital, seems to be true in the south, but not in the north.
Yeah, one of the things that makes a city special is that when people are there, they can learn from each other. What do we know about how important this learning effect is?
Well, it's certainly very important, right? I think both Ed and I agree on this. If cities are about something, it's mostly about learning.
Yeah.
Learning is still very much a face-to-face activity, something that really improves a lot when we can be together. And it's also about mixing with different people, people of different skills, of different backgrounds, and learning from them. An important barrier to that in poor economies is what Ed was saying in terms of segregation between skilled and unskilled workers. Another difficulty is making smaller cities attractive for skilled workers as well, right? Because often, you know, these are workers who are going to be demanding certain public goods, good schools for the kids, and safe neighborhoods and things like that. In many developing countries, those things are not available, or at least not as much in smaller cities. And then it makes it difficult to attract these skilled workers to the smaller cities. And if they are to be attracted there, then you end up needing to pay them more to compensate, which ends up undoing this urban premium that we were talking about before, right? So that's another reason why we see this being smaller in developing economies. There's more primacy, so there's a more domination by a single big city in many countries. Mm-hmm. And then when there are smaller and medium-sized cities, it's difficult to make them attractive for all kinds of workers.
So in the Brazilian cities of the north, a lot of the presence of skilled workers is associated with the public sector. Uh-huh. So typically, public sector wages tend to be fairly standardized in many nations. And this means if you get a public sector job in a very low wage, low cost area, you're actually earning a great deal. And that also leads to the segregation of the skilled. Add on the learning channel. So Nava Ashraf, Alexia Delfino, and I have been working on female entrepreneurship in Zambia, where we actually ask the entrepreneurs, where did they learn their skill? And one of the things that's really interesting is that the male entrepreneurs typically learn from other entrepreneurs, whereas the female entrepreneurs are learning from formal training, which suggests that they're having trouble taking advantage of this urban interaction machine that generates skills, perhaps because the men who are acting as entrepreneurs are just too difficult for them to cooperate with, either because, you know, as they say, the men either try to steal their stuff or try to sleep with them. The difficulties of women taking advantage of this is also a big and interesting research agenda.
We hear a lot about the idea that moving to a city might be a way to give female entrepreneurs the chance to realize their ambitions, to do better for themselves. Is that not true?
No, I think we think it is true, but we do think there's a significant gap by gender in terms of entrepreneurship. And women tend to be segregated in a small number of sectors, most notably food and apparel. They tend to earn much lower wages. They tend to like being in areas where you can partner with other women, in part to avoid the expropriatory behavior of men. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not that cities aren't offering things to both genders, but they may be offering more to men than to women, in part because they don't provide enough security for women to actually partner with a full range of people.
And that's the case for women entrepreneurs, but it's also the case for women workers and for women students as well.
Absolutely.
Things like improving security, safety, just in terms of getting on public transport, makes a big difference for girls spending more years in school. It's crucial for women to access jobs that are not nearby, and those things are still difficult. And even in developed countries, we see differences. Obviously, there are big opportunities in cities for both men and women, but we still see, even in rich countries, that when families have children, often the women end up looking for a job closer to home and giving up more interesting opportunities because it takes too long to get home or to be close to kids, whereas men don't behave in the same way, right? So even in developed countries, we'll still see these gender biases that really make it more difficult for women to take full advantage of the opportunities that cities provide.
There are other reasons why there might be this wage premium in cities. One thing that a lot of people might be thinking is cities just attract a different type of person, more educated, maybe more hardworking.
Sure. I mean, there's partly the story that people might be different to start with, and then they go to a city maybe because they're attracted by amenities or they want to sort for some other reason. So it may be that people who are in big cities tend to be different. It could be something to do with just intrinsic first nature advantages of cities, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not about cities making people more productive, but maybe there's something that intrinsically makes the location more productive and that brings people to move there. And that ends up making the place big. So it's productivity that leads to big size rather than a size that leads to big productivity, right? Mm-hmm. It could be just static advantages from working in cities, learning advantages. It could also be simply compensating differentials, right? It might be that firms, or some firms at least, need to be in a big city for some reason that has nothing to do with agglomeration economies. It could be that they need to be close to a port to export and that happens to be in a big city. It could be that they want to be close to politicians that they need to lobby. Because a big city is expensive, they need to pay their workers more in order to locate there, right? So to disentangle these things, we really need to have rich data. We need to follow workers over time with lots of details of what's going on in their working lives, and also to have detailed data tracking cities over time. That's not always easy to get in developing economies. It's starting to be more the case. I know Ed's work shows a few examples of that, like his work on Brazil, or if you cannot get a panel where you can follow the same workers over time, that you compare workers who have recently arrived in a city and you compare them with older migrants who have spent there some time and see how the premium is big or small for them, right? So there are ways around it. And And overall, what we see is that, for instance, reverse causality doesn't seem to be a big issue, right? This is really about cities leading to higher productivity, not higher productivity making cities bigger necessarily. Sorting appears to be important, but then it depends also on what you call sorting. It may not be so much that workers who are very able for some kind of intrinsic characteristic go to big cities, but it's precisely the fact that they go to big cities and spend time there and learn that really raises their human capital, gives them skills, and they end up being better, but not because they were better to start with, but precisely because going into a big city has made them better.
Ed, you also raised the argument that cities could be poverty traps for some of the people living there. How do we reconcile this story with the wage premium story that we've just been talking about?
So let me give you a US fact, and let me give you a developing world fact. It is a US fact from the Opportunity Atlas data compiled by Raj Chetty and his co-authors that kids who grow up in high-density urban neighborhoods end up doing worse as adults, holding their family's income constant. And this is as a kid who grew up in a dense neighborhood in New York. I didn't believe it for a long time, but it appears to be true. It's true. More central is worse. Going to a school right on the city side of a school district line is worse. Higher density is worse. And that certainly suggests, at least in the US, I have never seen any comparable data for France or Spain or any place else, but that certainly does suggest that cities can, in fact, fail their children. To the extent to which I have a hypothesis about it, it's the different level of mixing. This is, I guess, a running theme of what I'm saying, is the extent to which cities enable integration, mixing, learning from different people, they're powerful forces for good. To the extent to which they lead to hypersegregation, they can be forces for the contrary. And if you just think about a kid growing up in New York City disadvantaged area, that kid's parent is likely going to work in a reasonable job with educated people around him and reasonably wealthy people. But the kid is playing in a segregated neighborhood and going to a segregated school and living a life that's really painfully isolated. Now, I do have a paper on this with Cody Cook and Lindsay Currier in Nature Cities, but it's kind of hard to really establish this fact because we don't really have great cell phone data on kids. We have data on people over the age of 16. We can identify if they're spending a lot of time in their schools, and that's fine, but that's going to mix in the janitors, the teachers, and so forth. We do know that people who live in poorer areas just have much more limited lives in terms of their mobility throughout the city. We do know from the cell phone data that they are much less likely to visit lots of places. They travel less from home. They live a world that appears to be much more segregated. Second fact, this is from Marx, Stoker, and Suri, Journal of Economic Perspectives, about 10 years ago. We know that people who have been living for long periods of time in developing world disadvantaged areas, developing world slums, we know that they're not better off than people who have been living there for short periods of time. Now, this can either be interpreted as evidence for poverty traps, or it can be interpreted as the selection of who remains in the slum after 30 years, and those are not the guys who had a good draw. So I don't think we really know from that data. The Brazilian data certainly suggests that poor people are coming to cities and doing better. So that certainly suggests this. And I want to raise a book by a great social scientist, Janice Perelman, called Favela. In the 60s, she interviewed a first generation living in a Brazilian favela. And then 32 years later, she went back and looked at their children and grandchildren. And at least for this group, the level of upward mobility is mind-boggling. Now, it's not like she has a clear treatment and control. She's just looking at the first sample and their children and grandchildren. But they are doing much, much better. And it certainly isn't looking like the favela is serving as some kind of a poverty trap.
As you travel around the world and you go to any fast-growing city, the infrastructure of those cities lags behind as those cities grow. Do we know from research that there is a common way, as a template, to try and solve this problem?
To try and solve infrastructure? No, I don't think there is a template. I mean, different places have followed different models. There are different possible providers of infrastructure. There's public, there's private, there's public that's wholly part of the executive branch of government. There's public that's a parastatal or a separate state entity. There are ways of doing things. I mean, there's an East Asian way of development, which looks very different from the Latin American way, which looks very different from the African way. So there are different institutional models. I will say some things seem pretty ubiquitous. It's hard to find a developing world city without a lot of minibuses, just because there's such a cheap and nimble way of dealing with the mobility problem. Clean water is, I think, the most important job of city government, sort of always and everywhere. There, the problems of dealing with maintenance and dealing with infrastructure, they're close to ubiquitous. It's even harder to get poor people to pay for sanitation than it is for them to get them to pay for water. And lastly, I will say there are many cases in which two types of infrastructure overlap, two types of service, one of which is a rich world thing. I think, for example, a subway line or even a bus rapid transit. The other is the poor world version of things, which would be a low-cost minivan. I will make one last point, which is the intuition that we have from the wealthy world is typically that slow traffic speeds and, of course, incredibly long journeys to work are ubiquitous in many developing world cities, right? This is a pervasive feature of life. And some of that, of course, has to do with congestion. But the view that you fix congestion, you fix everything, which is kind of the wealthy world city view, that's just not right in the developing world. And we're increasingly learning this both from the work of my colleague, Gabriel Kreindler, working in India, and the work of Gilles Drantin, Diego's co-author and his many co-authors, looking at Google speeds everywhere. Both of these authors find that even at 3 a.m. in the morning, when roads are not congested, speeds are still quite slow, plausibly because of the low road quality.
Another problem of the growing cities that you have highlighted is what you call the last mile problem. What's the last mile problem and how can you fix it?
So the last mile problem is when some benevolent investor creates a water main and poor families are expected to connect to that water main. And the connection costs $1,000 and per capita income are $2,000. And the poor family says, thank you very much. We'd rather stick with our shallow well. We'd rather stick with our pit latrine. Mm-hmm. And it's a challenge because, of course, there are externalities associated with clean water. And we really want to encourage people to have clean water. We probably are going to be a little bit paternalistic towards the children of this family as well. And we shouldn't have been blindsided by this problem because it occurred in the U.S. as well. In 1842, New York City built its great, quote, an aqueduct. And for 25 years, poor families wouldn't connect to the aqueduct in many cases because it was expensive, because they didn't want to pay for the fees. And it wasn't until you had the Metropolitan Board of Health in 1866, which started imposing Pigouvian taxes on landlords who didn't connect, that you solved the problem. Now, in my own work with Giacomo Ponsetta and Nava Ashraf, we investigated this theoretically. And our view is that whatever fine you have, you don't want it to be large enough to lead to large-scale extortion of the poor. You want a smallish fine that doesn't lead to abuse. You certainly don't want to see police agents using this fine as a chance to extort the innocent, extort people who are actually already connecting. So that leaves you to keep it small, and then you have to take up with the rest with subsidies. And I think this is a general point about laws and urban externalities. The sort of Gary Becker answer, which is you want a really high fine and a really low probability of detection, that's almost assuredly wrong in the developing world. Because large fines are just a license for law enforcement authorities to extort money from people, to extort bribes. What you want is small, easy to enforce fines that don't go awry. So for example, my preferred solution to open street defecation is to punish kids who engage in open street defecation with making them do math problems in local community centers. So, you know, something they find unpleasant, but not something that's going to actually likely lead to a lot of bribery.
I think it was you, Ed, who described the building regulations in much of the developing world as shocking, over-regulation. What are cities losing by over-regulating?
I think most of the places that regulate heavily over-regulate. And certainly this is something that I first started to study in the U.S. context. But the great Alain Berthaud taught me 20 years ago about just how shocking Mumbai's land use regulations were, where for much of the last 55 years or so, much of the central city has been on a floor area ratio of 1.25. That means you can build to an average of 1.25 stories in Mumbai. This is apparently an imitation of the British Town and Country Planning Act. I cannot imagine anything that would be appropriate in Kent that would be appropriate for Mumbai. I mean, talk about an inappropriate set of institutions. Many parts of Latin America also overregulate, and we really want to be able to deliver the kind of density that enables people to live close to work, to live close to each other, to enable large-scale building. The problem also with low density is it means that you've really limited the way of outside capital in investing in ways that actually provide density for poor people. If we think about the cities of the West and the way that they grew in the 19th century, typically they grew by building up. They grew by building rentals, which housed poor people. This is often the right model. And I think by limiting height, we make it more difficult for developing world cities to do that.
I think density is important. But coming back to what we're discussing, integration is important as well, right? So that's something we see even in rich cities these days. Of course, it's very nice to have cities that are walkable and livable, and it's very nice to not have car-dependent cities. But at the same time, you have to be careful that what makes a city is really the fact that it's integrated, that people of all different types and skills and backgrounds get together and interact, and that's what really makes it productive and a place for learning and acquiring skills. Trying to turn a big city into a set of very segregated 15-minute neighborhoods is killing what the city is to start with. These days where we're trying to make cities livable, we still need to keep them integrated. I think that's an important message also to keep in mind.
I agree strongly with this. And there's a U.S. fact in a paper of mine in Nature Human Behavior that when poor people live in more 15-minute neighborhoods, they live more segregated lives.
So as you point out, this is a fantastically interesting topic. But if we want to understand city dynamics, low middle income countries, what sort of questions should researchers be asking now?
I think there are so many great questions. Mm-hmm. I think they can follow their passions. Certainly, there are great questions about the demons of density. So the downsides of urban living. Water is still a vastly under-researched topic. One of my favorite facts from my water work in Zambia, and this is not treatment and control, randomized control trial stuff, this is just a correlation, but the water supply problems get solved a lot more quickly for the customers who pay by the liter than the customers who pay by the month. And so if you have stronger incentives to get the water flowing again, apparently you get the water flowing again. I'd love to see more about the incentives that impact how institutions provide water. Transportation. We are in the midst of a great transportation revolution in economics, one in which fairly sophisticated models that combine both place of work and place of location. I'm thinking of the work of Steve Redding, this work of Costas Argalakis, the work of Trev Allen, and of course, it's being applied in developing world context by Nick Tsivanidis. It's great. There's a lot of great stuff on that. Of course, we've just experienced a global pandemic. Public health in cities is really interesting. Cities are vulnerable to plague, both because they're the nodes on our global lattice of travel and trade, and they're also just places where people live close to one another and can spread disease more quickly. And then, of course, there's crime. I mean, crime and violence are also often an urban topic, and that's a great topic as well. So there's just an enormous amount that can be done on the downsides of cities, as well as, I think we gave you a sense earlier, of all the rich things that can be done on the upsides of cities, on the fact that we become more productive when we're enmeshed in a maelstrom of economic activity.
And, of course, all these questions are, by definition, policy relevant. At this point, do policymakers know enough to maximize their economic benefits of these next wave of emerging cities, given the fact that clearly we made a lot of mistakes in the past?
I was going to let you handle that, Diego.
I will say something. We've talked about the angels and demons of density. Somehow this temptation often in policy to try to tweak with the angels. And I think that's very difficult to do, right? So there, I think there are some basic things in terms of what we've been discussing, in terms of keeping cities integrated and allowing people to move around and things like that. But I think, you know, it's much more difficult to do something useful there by trying to alter what's going on. Whereas with the cost of density, I think it's much more obvious when something is going wrong. And I think there's much more scope for useful policy interventions on the negative side than on the positive side of density.
Mostly on the angels, we're trying to get governments not to kill them off. Right? Mostly we're trying to get them not to like overregulate stuff or to create, as in the case of gender, to create enough rule of law that private entrepreneurs can make this work on their own way. With the demons, this is specifically the government's job to do battle against these demons. And no government knows enough, whether in the wealthy world or the poor world. And there's plenty of work to be done.
Ed, Diego, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
The course is designed for PhD students and researchers in economics and related fields, but it's open to everybody. You can find out about it at igc.org. You can watch recordings of the lectures, just in case you're worried that you missed this one. You can download the slides and the reading lists as well. There will not be a test. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode, subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org. And if you like what you're hearing, please tell someone else about us.